Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
What do we mean when we say the word technology? Is it only those mechanical things we're used to? Is it only the internet? What is technology? And what if our definition of technology is inadequate? That is, it doesn't take into account all of the various items that could be considered technology or technological. We're going to talk about what technology is and look at technology from a different or neglected perspective on the show today. To help us with our conversation, we have Clapperton Chakanetsa Mavunga, who is an associate professor of science, technology, and society at MIT. This is New Books in Technology. I'm your host, Jasmine McNeely. All right, so the book is called Transient Workspaces, Technologies of Everyday Innovation in Zimbabwe. Now, before we even start up talking about the book, one of the first things we like to do is get some background on the author. So who is Clapperton Chakanetsa Mavunga?
He's a simple boy who grew up in rural Africa. Traveling 10 miles a day to school. And I grew up herding cattle. I grew up doing all kinds of things that an African boy would do. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm coming from. And I grew up in a family of 10.
Okay.
Six boys and four girls. And I was the fifth of the youngest boys, and I was the second from last. So this is me.
Okay. And so now you are an associate professor?
That's correct.
At MIT?
That's correct.
So what was the route to MIT?
I would say I was schooled in this very inspirational space called poverty. Some may think of it as a kind of pathology, but I don't think that without it I would have been where I am. I pretty much grew up in very difficult circumstances where the only hope you had was to, to become somebody. You had to go to school and you had to continue to scrape until you got where you wanted. I had parents who had a lot of faith in my abilities very early on. And so that made it very easy. I would burn the midnight oil quite literally because it was paraffin, a small paraffin lamp, self-made. And until it was around 2 o'clock. And I remember my dad would come and knock. Clapperton, are you still awake? And then I would say, yeah, I'm still reading. So I was quite an avid reader from very early on. So this is what then took me to University of Zimbabwe, finished my honors degree in history in 1995. And then I took a break. Then I went back to school again three, four years later. This time to do my master's in history at Wits University in South Africa. But I was dissatisfied at that point that, how is it that the history of Africa is only accounted for in social terms, but then where is technology in this? Where is science in this? Where is innovation? Where is entrepreneurship? Is it that we didn't have this? How come the same things that, other nations like the Romans were doing, how come those kinds of things that they account for as technology are also not accounted for, even if they are present in our own story? You see, so I began to reflect on these stories. Where is this? I didn't find it in South, in the South African education system because I had a fits at that time. So hence the decision to go to Michigan. And then that, it's from Michigan that I was lucky to come to MIT and be part of this institution.
Okay. And you teach science, technology, and society, right?
Correct.
Which is all part of this book, Transient Workspaces.
Yeah.
Now, you just talked for a moment about how you got your history degree at the University of Zimbabwe.
Right.
And you use a lot of history in this book.
I'm a historian.
Yes.
So in my entire, put it this way, in my entire university career, I have not studied anything else but history.
Okay.
And a little bit, it's only at Michigan that I began to study STS and environment and anthropology. But then the core of it is history.
Yeah.
So I tend to be the historian, quite dyed in the wool. And no apologies for this.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the book, Transient Workspaces, Technology of Everyday Innovation in Zimbabwe. And, you know, one of the questions you posed to yourself earlier when you were studying at a university in South Africa.
South Africa.
Was about why is the history of technology and the continent of Africa not really being told or recognized as technology or technological innovation. And so I wanted to ask you about the narrow definition that is modernly connected to the word technology.
And
the problems associated with such a narrow definition.
And you can notice that, you know, it's not the concept of technology itself is not a very old concept. Even so, now the present state of my research is that I'm revisiting scholarship that we do not think was STS, but was being was talking about technology in the late 1800s, for example. I'm thinking of the work of Otis Masson, who was writing of a concept called technogeographies. And he was saying there is no society in the world that does not have technology. Every society has it. But it's a question of the distribution, our distribution as humankind on Earth, and the geographical regions that we inhabit. That is why you can how you explain the kaleidoscopic nature of what kind of things constitute technology in what kind of a place. So I've been reading further, and I'm finding that perhaps that the problem, for me at least, is that people assume what technology already is, which is my problem with Western STS, because we already, it's as if the meaning has already been decided. What science is, what technology is, it's already been decided. All we are there to do is to come and, you know, the table is laid. Come, just come and eat. And eat quietly, exercise table manners. I want to shake the ground a little bit and say technology means a lot of things to different people. We could, in fact, you know, just break it down to the bare basics. And talk about means and ways to ends which raises the question, if we say that this whole notion of who designs, who is an engineer, who is a user, really begins to be more interesting, and words like that we become more careful to use.
So I was just going to ask you then, what would your definition of technology be?
Simple. It's a means and ways that people use to do things towards specific ends, which does not rule out any So I'll give you an example. The example that I use in the book is one about what we often call ritual when we are speaking of non-Western societies. Mm-hmm. As if it can be called these principles and kind of laid out methods that you have to follow, the do's and don'ts that you would find in a laboratory.
Right.
So I've been thinking recently, if we carry that discussion to its logical conclusion, is there a way in which scholarship from the South or scholarship that has not been represented in the past can actually open up new ways of thinking about what a laboratory is, what science is, and not perhaps no longer just singular but plural, what technology constitutes, not as defined by the laboratory, which we have been socialized to know, but also a dual exercise of defining both what the laboratory is and what technology might be.
Sure.
So it is a question. For me, it's a question. The question of definitions is perhaps the most important question of the 21st century.
Okay.
Because the people who are now participating in this debate are no longer as narrow as the people that were participating when the definition of technology and science was first used or proposed.
Right.
Yeah. We can't just come here and accept things as they are. We bring our own perspective. And no perspective ought to be wrong simply because of prior occurrence.
Well, you know, the issue that you're getting into, it seems to be about power dynamics, right?
Yes.
And you talk about critique of, the different power dynamics and things like imperialism and colonialism in your book with respect to how we even now define the word technology and modernity.
Absolutely. And you see, these words came to Africa via a carriage called colonialism, called imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the way they were used, technology was used a bit later on from the 30s onwards, but progress, civilization, and its opposite, the savage, and other concepts that denote even development. Development was used in very evolutionary terms, which justified the designation of some people as civilized and others as savage. And these were then racialized.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is impossible for us to evade by some God trick these specific situated dynamics within which this terminology arrived. We cannot. Otherwise, we'll be doing a great injustice to history. And unfortunately, what I often see is people readily take concepts that are already settled in the Western academy and just carry them forward. And they say, oh, here is another example. They mobilize Africa and other parts of the global South and non-represented cultures that were not represented before, is just the fodder for confirming or disproving what they already have already packaged in Western scholarship. I think we have to be more serious than that.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we risk not contributing anything. Scholars who are very comfortable with the Western paradigm and have been enunciating, you say, thank you very much. You're just confirming what we knew. Exactly. Precisely because our contribution is already marked as a Western contribution. It is not a Global Southern contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. So let's perhaps get into some other definitions, some other terms that you use a lot in the book. One of those is mobility. The mm-hmm. other one is, from the title at least, but also throughout the book, and that is transient workspaces. So how would you define those for the audience?
Transient workspace is a space. What I was trying to do there was to say that people, when they move,
This is not just for me, the importance is not just conveyance from one place to the other. Place shifting, but more to do with the work that mobility or a movement does, what it is doing, and the kinds of traces and processes of encounter that, you know, it configures or are configured upon it.
So we have to also be attentive to not only the work that mobility itself does, but the work that is permissible because of movement. That's what I was trying to get. In a world where we now have somebody who is 13,000 feet above ground level busy typing on a computer, where in a world where we have drones being delegated killing power, in a world where people you find Starbucks today are not just idling or wasting time or just relaxing, but are also at work, even when they are mobile and getting coffee, doing anything. These gadgetries are only reminding us of a mobility as work. But is this new? This was the question why I was. That's why I was interested in the hunters, because I wanted to say it's very easy for me to have made that argument using cell phones. But I was. It came out of this a very deep introspection on what being on the hunt means, tracking, and through tracking, it's a space of education of kids, not only in the killing or the tracking of an animal, which in itself is a very sophisticated process, tracking, but also in schooling generations of kids in how to think about and to respect the forest as a kind of multifaceted a resource as well as a sacred space. It was a space where you could actually think of the pharmacy from a pre-colonial perspective, a non-big pharma perspective. So that's what I was trying to do with transient workspace, to say it might well be the defining mode of work in our time, where we are seeing the reduction of a idle time or a dead time, as some other scholars have called it, and the multitasking of movement, so that it also becomes a space where you do, and time where you do work, which you might otherwise have done if you have only after you have arrived home or in a workshop. So, which is why earlier on, when I started in my dissertation, I was calling this a mobile workshop. But I got disillusioned with the word workshop. It didn't quite. Recently, Mamadou Diouf suggested that a French word could be atelier. So it could be, instead of a mobile workshop, it could be atelier mobile. But still, I wanted something that is translated in my own language. And that's why I settled on transient workspaces.
Now, part of the book, you do get into the Vashona and Masangana.
Mashangana. Yeah.
Good, thank you.
They originally called the Sengwe. But then, because of the convenience of being identified as Changana and the advantages that came with it, they just call themselves Machangan.
Well, you get into the philosophy of life, and you also talk about spiritually guided mobility.
Yes.
With respect to both groups. And I was wondering if you could talk about that more with respect to, you know, technology and how perceptions of technology have changed or impacted things in Zimbabwe and that area.
In fact, where I wanted to start was where, if you look at the kind of literature we have in STS, most of it is evacuated of the spiritual. And it could be that So there are two things they are evacuated of. One is the spiritual. The second one is the communal. What is emphasized more, the human and the machine? Also emphasized is the individual.
Uh-huh.
And my argument is that even human is dehumanizing. Since when did we talk only about human as opposed to people? That's where I am now. Regardless of what I wrote in the book, that's what I wanted to say. That's what I wanted to draw attention to, that perhaps we should return to people as opposed to human, because human just dehumanizes. It turns us, it removes the human being and renders us species.
Okay.
So that's what I want, and what I was trying to do with spiritually guided mobility was to say that from where I come from, the idea that, you know, you travel alone as a human in society, as a species, it's simply not how people see. Now, and I'm not rejecting the idea that, you know, people can't see themselves that way. They should. But they should not disapprove of other ways of seeing. We should be democratic about this. And the way I chose it was that every facet of life and the life after this one is guided by the ancestral spirits, according to this culture I was examining.
Uh-huh.
It's guided by Emikwembu, it's guided by Wadzimu. And the idea was that once you have anything that is guided by the spirits, you cannot therefore claim individual. You can't say, beat yourself on the chest if you have asked for the providence of the spirits. If you were going into the forest, then you are coming back and you beat yourself on the chest that it was your own doing. It wasn't. That does not mean that, you know, being guided by the spirits does not absolve you from a skill. Skill was a spirit. You can't, it was indivisible from a spirit. Skill was a spirit, the spirit of expertise. So there is no distinction whatsoever between the spiritual. In fact, the spiritual functions as a guidance, as an anchor, the guide to innovation, rather than the anthropological perspective where the perception was that, well, they are too superstitious, therefore that's why they can't innovate. It's actually that which they call superstition that, when removed by Christian missionaries, completely also swept the rug from under the carpet of African modes of innovation. It's the worst kind of knowledge genocide that could have happened, this conversion.
Yeah, so let's talk about one of the other questions I had was about the integration or the bringing of outside technology or ideas into these societies that are already established and already have ways of believing, knowing, and working or doing things, and the impact that has on that society and how society impacts that outside technology as well.
Yeah, yeah. So what I was trying to do was to say that we should take note of the, I guess what you are referring to is this question of appropriation and appropriate technology. How, and I had my mind on the cell phone today, but I did not want to tackle the cell phone. I was interested in something more historical, which was to ask about the genealogy of appropriation in the African context. And the way I wanted to do it was to not valorize the idea of appropriating outside things alone, as if Africa's future only lies in, or a past has been about appropriation only of things from outside. I was trying to say that what the question I was trying to say is, what precedes appropriation? What comes before appropriation? When people appropriate, what is that a sign of? Because to me, it's a sign. It's a symptom. But a symptom of what? And I think it's a symptom of an inner beautiful beast that is very, very innovative, is spiritually, deeply spiritually, communally anchored. And that has a tendency of being very flexible to outside things, not only receiving them, but seeking them out. Because the Africans that I know there are not just merely waiting until the Europeans come with their gun. They are actually going to the mines to work and get guns. They are going to sell ivory to incoming people and saying, we need that one and that one and that kind of gun and that kind of cloth and so on.
Yeah, so they're not just passive.
No. No, they are not. It's where I return to the question of, if you are thinking of writing an African history of technology, you can't just say technology in Africa. It's the trick that you find a lot of people wanting to take, that, you know, African technology is, they can't talk about that. They can't talk about African technology. They want to talk about technology in Africa. I like technology in Africa insofar as it's actually talking not just about what insiders are bringing. And if you look at the literature on STS, a lot of it is talking about, these things that are coming from outside, and that's just following them around, and how people might place meanings to them around, but basically they are the same old, same old. There's nothing new there. I don't find those stories very exciting or sophisticated. I'm interested in a story that traces two kinds of trajectories. One, the trajectory of the things that are incoming, on the one hand, the trajectories of things African, and where these Africans that are interfacing with these things are coming from. And it's at that intersection that I want them to trace to explain that encounter.
So this brings us back, I think, full circle to the question of narrative and who, first of all, what the story is in relationship with Africa and technology, but then who gets to tell the story of Africa and Africans and technology. And you touch on that a lot in your book.
I do. And one of the things that has happened, and I come from Zimbabwe, where most of the stories about Zimbabwe are written by outsiders. One very good example, just look at all the biographies of Robert Gabriel Mugabe, the president. Until some have come up recently, not one has been written by anybody who is black or African. Doesn't that surprise us? And you look at Zimbabwean history proper, except for Ngwabi Bebe, Hoini Bila, and a few others, the majority of books now coming out on Zimbabwe are written by non-Zimbabweans. And as Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie warns, there is a danger in a single story. We need to have Africans not relying on these accounts. The audience, the topics that people are writing about our experience are not the ones that we choose. They elect what to write. They don't substitute. They have legitimate questions just like we do. But they may not be legitimate to us. And we are not hidebound to follow their paradigms. So, for example, when they import these categories to try and explain Africa, one question we should be attentive to is, to what kind of knowledge store are they contributing? To an African history? An African's perspective? Or to a history of Africa, which can be diverse, and anyone is welcome to write? This is why I think we need to be careful about what constitutes an Africanist perspective. which I don't write from, and an African perspective, which is where I write from. But I also write from a second space, which is Africa, a kind of an Africa-focused history, which is that anyone can come to that if the central voices that are emanating from this account are African. Not to load them with all these theoretical pork, Heidegger, of Latour, of all these guys. A lot of them spent very little time or no time at all in Africa. And then you mobilize the history of an entire society to that. I was trying to do something else in this. If you look at the introduction, it's a critique and an update on the state of the world. You could think of it as a vent, kind of frustration. The book proper for me, if you think of it as a work of theory, starts in chapter 1 on guided mobility. That's for me where I start, where I am actually making the move that the theorists, I'm not the theorist. I'm not the philosopher. The philosophers are my ancestors. They are the ones that developed all this vocabulary to order the knowledge that I write. I'm merely a student, but also a steward to the end, and an heir to knowledge that I only can claim expertise on the basis of having lived it. And so I am trying to say it is not just enough for us to just take this kind of knowledge and call it our archive, our empirical fodder. And not, we don't call it theory, we don't call it philosophy. It's just an archive. I think there is something very dangerous with that, because then we appoint ourselves the experts. But what credentials do we have to claim expertise to societies to which we are outsiders? I mean, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years does not make one the expert any more than a lived lifetime makes somebody an expert. I think it's the latter that is often suppressed. Yeah, we need to take these voices seriously as theoretical standing points.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book is Transient Workspaces, Technology of Everyday Innovation in Zimbabwe, and it's out now.
It is out, yes.
On MIT Press, right? And they can pick it up anywhere, Amazon, MIT Press, obviously. So one of the other things that we always like to ask on New Books in Technology is, what's next? What's next for Mr. or Professor Muvunga?
What's next? So I am finishing a book now on what I call How an African Knowledge Became Science. And I'm basically saying that many policies that we need to move away from the idea that when Europeans came, they just obliterated our knowledge and imposed Western templates. My argument is actually that they built the knowledge they used to oppress Africans and other colonized people anywhere else. A lot of that knowledge was built on pre-existing knowledge of indigenous people they found. So the example that I take is that of the knowledge of trees, the knowledge of animals, and the knowledge of pest control. And I show, and so what I do is I'm using the accounts of the colonists confessing about how they did this. For a long time, we've been told, oh, the colonial archive is biased, it's full of these things. I'm saying, no, don't let them off too cheaply. I want to hear them confess and present them as confessing how exactly they were taking this knowledge. One good example is where you have these medical schools throughout in the United States, in Britain, in Europe, They were sending one expedition after another to Africa to collect what they called voucher specimens and to document the names of all the medicinal plants. This is just one example, medicinal plants that African healers and in some cases even people designated as witches were using.
Mm-hmm.
And these were medical anthropologists working for medical schools. And these were the same specimens that were then used as starting points or that were tested bioassayed and used as basis for pharmaceutical drugs. Now, where does science start then? It starts from the laboratory or it starts from these people?
Right.
The question for me is to, the audience of it is not necessarily the scientists. The audience for me are the people of Africa and other peoples in the world who have such a low opinion of their own ancestral knowledge, because they, when they look at that knowledge, they say, oh, if I go to CVS or the pharmacy, I just buy a capsule. Oblivious to the fact that that kind of capsule actually came from the tree that underneath they are sitting. So I'm hoping for a knowledge that eventually will begin to awaken people of Africa, young innovators. And also here, for my students, for example, to recognize that Africa is not just this one vast dust bowl of misery, disease, and war, that a lot of very good things that they may not be aware of have actually come out of Africa. And build on that. Build new smart partnerships on the basis of mutual respect. The idea being that theirs, if we teach them here at MIT, theirs is just one domain of knowing. There are multiple others out there. And good things can only come from working across different knowledge domains.
That sounds amazing, and we certainly look forward to reading that book when it comes out as well. And so we thank you for coming on the show today. The book is Transient Workspaces, that is the technology of everyday innovation in Zimbabwe, and the author is Clapperton Chakanetsa Mavunga. And we thank you for coming on New Books in Technology.
Natin, thank you very much. We'll be right back.